This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello and a very good afternoon to you. Today, the Bee Industry Council of Western Australia is urging all Western Australians to remain vigilant following the recent detection of varroa in South Australia's Riverland region. We'll take a look at that just before the news headlines at 12:30 today. And then a little later in the hour, a Kununurra cotton grower is just back from a great trip to Brazil, where he saw right up close the world's largest centre pivot irrigation system. So he's going to share a little bit of his trip and what he saw with you a little later this hour. And then it's off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market just before the news at 1. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia. First up today, some important grains industry news for you. 5 to 7 shiploads of Australian canola are understood to be heading to China in the next few months as part of a trial to reopen the Chinese market to Australian canola. Vitor Pistoia is a senior analyst for grain and oilseeds with Rabobank. He says the market is still officially closed, but there are promising signs for next year.
The news came roughly in July, if I'm not mistaken, when we had the Australian visit, the official visit in China. And it started as like people are talking about this, and then newspapers started to talk about this, and basically it became an official thing. So in a nutshell, what we have is that Chinese government and the Chinese traders, they committed 5 to 7 boats, 40 to 50,000 tons each. Roughly, that's the size of the boats that we export on canola. So, 250,000 tons.
That's what's going over.
Potentially.
But the market is still officially closed.
Yes, it's just a trial.
A trial of 500,000 tons.
250,000.
250,000 ton trial.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the story that everyone is getting.
And is that what's lining up with what you're hearing as well?
Yes, yeah. China has some restrictions on the specs to import canola. Well, we have three that really impact and make trade, as of today, not easily to be done. The first is the black leg disease, strict requirements into that. The second is the GM component. There is a short list of varieties that potentially will expand. Therefore, more production is eligible to go there. And the third is about screenings. China has allegedly also, all the information that we get also from our competitors overseas, is that China has a 1% screening limit, and that's a little bit off for Australian standards. So if those 5 book vessel, or can be 7 book vessel trial, they go forward and they succeed, potentially, if the governments, Canberra and Beijing, they get along, the right handshakes are done, maybe in 2026, the Chinese canola market can open to Australia. And on the scene also, we have the Chinese tariffs in the Canadian canola.
Mm.
So if you do the math, okay, so China is closing the door of an important exporter, but maybe China will open the door for another important exporter. Like, if you connect the dots, you can have a drawing, right? So that's the scenario that we can go into 26, that we will continue to supply European Union, we will continue to supply UAE, Japan, and some other Asian countries, and we can have the possibility to supply China. You're going to ask me, wow, what about the numbers? Is that going to be price supportive or not? Well, in theory, yes, because it's another player. But also, we need to understand that the Chinese demand for canola is not massive. It's not a question that they're going to buy 50, 80 million tons of canola, because the numbers are not there. They can come to us, they can buy 1, 2, 3 million tons, but it will be a limit, because just what they usually get from Canada, that now the doors are shut, it's basically our whole crop.
Is what they are now looking for. Yeah.
So in the 2024 calendar year, China bought 5.9 million tons of Canadian canola. That's 100% of our crop, right? We are discussing to produce 6.5 this year. So it's not that it's going to be a complete substitution, because we have the non-GM component. We know that the European market, pays well and is unlikely that the Chinese will top up. It can happen. Well, we're living in strange times, but as of today, that's not that likely to happen.
Yeah. So there's three things that you mentioned, screenings and blackleg.
And the GM varieties.
So GM varieties that WA is growing, are they accepted in China? Or would China need to change their rules there?
Basically, it needs to change, include, expand the list. Not change, expand the list. It's a question of having the varieties with the green lights on. I would say that's the easiest of all, because you can do the test, the GM component, they have already the precedent of having varieties on. Based on the phytosanitary rules of global trade of grains, the blackleg disease is the key one, because that's like on-off. We can have it or we cannot have it. And that applies for other grains in other industries. That is one of the key barriers.
Mm-hmm. All of those things, though, are a matter of China changing its rules, its end. There's not really a lot that Australia can do when Australia says it's in negotiations with the Chinese government.
As an exporter, as a seller, our job is to show that we have safe products, that we are a reliable supplier, that we have competitive prices, and we do that for many supply chains. Like, we are an exporting nation on the grain industry front as well. I will go easy here, but it's a lot about politics, right? This is like big, big talks of global trade that goes back to the condition that we are living on tariffs. That's part of the equation. So that's why news can come overnight.
Mm. When do you think we may see some official news coming out about the Chinese market? You've got these 5 to 7 vessels that are heading over. When might that market maybe officially open, do you think?
Well, it takes some months to load a vessel, send it, unload, do all the checking. So my personal expectation is that we will see something by early 2026. That's my go-to date.
Yeah. And does that mean that those vessels would have, they will all go in the next few months?
Yeah.
Yeah. And out of where, do you think? Western Australia?
We'll have to wait and see.
Rabobank's Vitor Pistoia speaking to Joe Prendergast about those 5 to 7 shiploads of Australian canola, which are understood to be heading to China in the next few months as part of a trial to reopen the Chinese market to Australian canola. I did contact the Department of Agriculture for an official update on the status of the China canola market. I'm told the Australian government negotiates improvements to conditions for agricultural trade with all trading partners, including China. This is an active and ongoing government-to-government discussion, and details have not yet been finalised. 12:13. Well, in other canola news today, WA grain growers currently undergoing an ISCC certification audit to allow them to continue to supply canola to the European market, say the requirements are excessive, intrusive, and in some cases, totally irrelevant. Peter Horwood grows wheat, lupins and canola on his farm near Mingenew, 360 kilometres north of Perth. Peter, in June you were notified that your farm would be audited and you were provided with a support person to sort of help you through that process. What information exactly are they looking for in this audit?
They want to know farm inputs. And some of these things I think are totally irrelevant, but that's what they want. You know, the list of inputs, they've gone through gypsum, lime, fertilizer, fuel, electricity, chemicals, maybe yes, seed cleaning, maybe yes or no. They're sort of the inputs, but so you've got to supply invoices, and maybe supplying an invoice for fertilizer, fuel, ag chem, it's private and confidential information between you and your supplier of those products, just for a start. They want to see grain sales and contracts for the canola. To be involved in the audit, they know you're selling canola, so why do you need it? They want to know hectares, production areas of your grains and other grains which are not even caught up in the audit. So why do they need to know that? There's an area of, you know, commodity, total tonnes harvested and the years and the average, or it works out the average year, that's irrelevant for lupins and wheat because it's not mixed up in our situation. They want farm maps. Why do they really want farm maps? What's the relevance of that? If you're still running livestock, there's a question here in that. There's employees' contracts, and that is totally irrelevant. And you get to know other farmers in the district who are also being audited, and they've also raised it. Why do they need to see farm contracts? And I've raised this with other farmers in Australia outside the audit system, and they just look at me and say, it's none of their business.
And how comfortable are you passing on all of this information?
Well, as I said, employees' contracts, and to be honest, I discussed this with my employee. It's not their business. This is one area maybe I'm honing in on, but I have discussed this with other people being audited and they've got the same opinion as me.
And what do they do with all of this information?
Good question. And that's why, you know, the question was asked around security. And I know they have been challenged on the security issue. When you start talking, you find a lot more information out with different people. So they have been challenged on security. I've also, in one of the people who's been audited, they've been advised as soon as the audit's over to get all the information off the computer. It's, you know, information's king these days, but, you know, if they want to see the chemical side and what we do, well, that. But I think it's going over and beyond. And I think in Western Australia, we can be caught up with inside the ISCC system and CBH are separate. So you could end up potentially being audited for the same thing 2 years in a row. And why not just have one system as well?
Well, how important is this market to you? Because the certification process is for canola going into the European market. Are you that keen to stay in the market that you're going to go through with this process, or you're thinking about doing the audit anyway?
We're going to go through with the audit, but you've got to also realise on the world stage, I don't believe Canadians are audited. I don't know where their canola goes. You know, potentially with the Chinese wanting more canola, but most of our canola actually might go to China anyway.
Peter, it's really great to have you on the Country Hour today and just to get an insight into what this process is like. I really appreciate it.
No, look, thanks, Belinda. And look, if it can help someone in the future to not to be so stressed, that's also a win.
Sure is. Peter Hallwood, who's a grain grower from Mingenew, 18 past 12. Mark Fowler is the president of the WA Farmers Grains Council. Mark, what do you make of the amount of information that's required in this ISCC certification process that allows growers to continue accessing the European canola market?
Belinda, we would say what we have been saying for a long time, and that is that the ISCC scheme is a massive overreach, and that it goes well beyond what is necessary to access the European markets and to properly demonstrate our sustainability credentials, which we need to do, to the rest of the world.
There's no other option, though, is there? I mean, if you want to keep accessing that European market, you need to do this audit if your number comes up.
That's what the trade would have you believe, but it's not the whole story. In order to access the European market, you need only comply with the requirements of the Renewable Energy Directive, which are much less onerous. One of the requirements of that Renewable Energy Directive scheme is that you comply with an accredited sustainability accreditation scheme. The ISCC scheme is just one of those, but that scheme goes well beyond the requirements of the Renewable Energy Directive, so much so that in a recent study, they found that the requirements that go beyond the Renewable Energy Directive were 92% of their requirements. So, and it is important to point out that there are many other schemes. There's 14 other schemes accredited under the Renewable Energy Directive, which are therefore complying schemes which growers could use in countries to get their product into the European biofuels market.
So why aren't they being chosen?
Well, it's interesting. We did actually previously use another scheme when you, in the early days of the sustainability certification in the West Australia market. We used the 2BSVS model, which was a skinnier model that was abandoned at some point by traders in preference for ICC. And the ICC scheme was, when it began here, a fairly slim scheme where you didn't have to demonstrate very much to comply with it. But over time, its requirements have grown, and grown in a way that doesn't necessarily match the context which is applicable in Australia and certainly in Western Australia. It's very much a European scheme. It's not really a global scheme, even though it has taken hold as a sustainability accreditation scheme. It's a brand that is recognised around the world, but it is international in name only. It's a European sustainability scheme, and it's very much driven by their own sustainability context, and they're the only ones that have any input to it. Australian consumers, growers, citizens have no input into the ICC scheme. It's driven 100% by Europe.
But at this stage, the farmers who have been or in the process of being audited, do they have a choice at this point, though? Because if they want to keep accessing that market, that is the system in front of them. That is the audit process in front of them.
Well, in Western Australia, that's the only option that we have access to do that. And if you are notified that you are going to be audited, well, you have to comply with that because you've basically agreed as a matter of your grain contract that you are going to be paid an additional sum of money because you have declared yourself to be compliant. So that's the
incentive. There's extra money in it for your canola if you go through this process and sell it under the ISCC scheme.
That's a very good question. It's quite murky. We've tried many times to find out what the true premium that the trade has been able to achieve using this scheme. And it, of course, changes from year to year. In years where Europe is the main buyer, then there is clearly more of a premium in accessing the European market. In years where Europe isn't the main buyer, and say, for example, we understand there's interest from other premium paying markets like China, the more that comes into play, the less there is a true premium. But we always see a difference in non-ICC and ICC prices. And sometimes we don't think it's warranted, and sometimes we think it's actually the traders are subsidising those ICC certified tonnes with money from the tons that are not certified. And we think that's inappropriate. We'd like to see greater transparency around that. We've asked many times, even to CBH, and they're very cagey about it and very unwilling to provide more information around that.
As you've just mentioned, and as we heard earlier from Rabobank analyst, there appears to be 5 to 7 shiploads of Australian canola understood to be heading to China in the next couple of months as part of a trial to reopen the Chinese market to Australian canola, which could open officially next year. But at the moment, we're looking at these 5 to 7 trial shiploads. What would that mean to the market here in WA, Mark?
Oh, I think it can only be a good thing. The more demand, the better. And China has proven to be a premium-paying market in the past. And interestingly, Andrew Whitelaw from Episode 3 put up a graphic on social media, I think it was probably a month ago, showing that the premiums that they paid when they were in the market last were at least equal to what Europe was paying. So that would, and China typically hasn't had made requirements in this space. So that will put pressure on the logic that the ICC scheme is producing a premium. And again, I would make the point, whenever that claim is made, you have to drill deeper and say, is it the ICC scheme or is it the ability to access the European market? And if it's the ability to access the European market, it's the Renewable Energy Directive requirements that are key here. Not all of the other 92% requirements over and above the ICC the extra requirements that the ICC imposes over and above the Renewable Energy Directive.
Mark, really good to get your thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks, Belinda.
Mark Fowler, who is president of the WA Farmers Grains Council. 24 past 12.
The Country Hour.
I found it pretty good, actually.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You never knock back rain.
The Country Hour.
You know, you should get around it.
Part of your community and your life for 80 years. On ABC Radio.
Get an update from the newsroom for you shortly, then off to the Bureau of Meteorology, check conditions around the state. There is some rain on the way. a front or a series of fronts, I think it might be. Anyway, we'll get the latest from the Bureau shortly here on the Country Hour and see what's heading your way. First, though, the Bee Industry Council of Western Australia is urging all Western Australians to remain vigilant following the recent detection of varroa in South Australia's Riverland region. Now, varroa mites, they're tiny parasites, and what they do is attach to the bodies of honeybees and eat them alive. Australia was the last continent to be free of the deadly parasite before it was detected in New South Wales in 2022, and since then has found its way into Victoria, Queensland and the ACT. Brendan Fuster is the director of the Bee Industry Council of Western Australia. He believes it was almost inevitable varroa would make its way into South Australia, and now WA needs to do everything possible to prevent it travelling across the Nullarbor.
It's really sad. The varroa has travelled that far that quickly. Getting it into another state is not ideal. It's disappointing. Initial feeling is that it was inevitable once they started bringing bees in from the East Coast.
What do you mean by that? Because over here in Western Australia, I know we have some pretty strict biosecurity laws here. So how come they can move more freely on the East Coast?
Yeah, well, the East Coast has been, everyone's been able to move within the states until varroa. South Australia had a border restriction on once varroa hit New South Wales, but unfortunately it was let lapse because of pollination requirements. One industry's demand for bees has cost now South Australia getting varroa.
It is only one hive that has been found infested at this stage. So is that, still a cause for serious concern, do you believe?
Yes, yeah, it is. I mean, once it gets to numbers where it's being found in an alcohol wash, pretty guaranteed it'll be in other hives. So it'll be hard to declare the area free, even if you can move those bees out. But I'm not sure what the protocol will be over there.
How concerned should Western Australian beekeepers be about this latest discovery?
Oh, well, look, it just gets it closer to our border. You know, South Australia's our neighbour. Once they've got it, it just moves a whole lot closer to our border. So then we've just got to be, you know, the whole state, we really have to be strict on our border restrictions and doing everything right to stop anything coming into this state. Because as we sort of speak, we're trying to get bees into South Australia clean, free of varroa, so they can pollinate their hives. So yeah, it's an important part. If WA can stay varroa free, we then can probably aid the other states with bee numbers when they're required.
Yeah, Brandon, I feel like it wasn't many weeks ago I was speaking to you about hives being sent from here in WA to our neighbours in South Australia to support the almond producers. And now we've got this news that there's the first detection of varroa mite in the state. Like, this certainly raises fresh concerns.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was inevitable, I think, once those bees came in. You know, the bees from WA, we're varroa free as we speak, so we wanted to try and supply varroa free bees to South Australia for their pollination, so they didn't have to take that risk. But unfortunately, we just couldn't get enough up in the time frame that was required, and this is what's happened. So
does that mean you almost feel like the bees that you have sent into South Australia, it's almost a bit of a waste then?
Not so much, no. I mean, our bees will be going over there and doing their job, be pollinating. They're just going to have to deal with varroa, as do most of the bees around the world.
I know as well, Brendan, that you said that, you know, if this worked, this, you know, cross-border collaboration, sending our bees to South Australia, if it worked, then you'd look at doing this in the years to come. Is that something you'd still consider with this news?
Yeah, look, we would. We certainly would. It could be a strong position for WA to be in if we can keep our bees healthy and strong and be able to get them, build them up the numbers that are required to go over and pollinate a lot of different crops. Almonds is just a start. Nearly all the crops are going to need some form of pollination. A lot of our fruits, you know, avocados, a lot of those require pollination. At the moment, they've been getting free pollination from the feral bees, but as varroa takes a hold of an area, the feral bees dwindle away to about 1-3% of what they currently are, and so that free pollination service is gone. So what's required then is managed hives, the ones that we are managing using unfortunately having to use its chemicals and stuff in the hives to keep the pest at bay, so we can then put bees onto the pollination to keep us eating. What I think is the most important point to get across here is that it's food security. It's keeping food on the table is what we're talking about.
The Industry Council of Western Australia Director Brendan Fuster speaking to Kate Forrester about the latest detection of varroa mite in South Australia. We have asked to speak to the WA Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis on this topic and a few other things too. Hopefully, you'll hear from her soon. This on the text, it only takes one truckie or four-wheel drive to hit a bee swarm. And then a bee gets stuck in his cab and finally gets out when he's across the border and goes to visit another hive over here. Be part of the conversation. If you've got something to contribute, it would be great to hear from you. The text is 0448 922 604. 12:30, Tony Carr is here with the latest from the newsroom. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. WA's Police Minister Rhys Whitby says there's no excuse for the force used by officers during an incident in the goldfields where a man was tasered. Body-worn camera footage shows an officer twice shoving Lance Stewart to the ground. Another officer then tasers the Matu man after he stands up and adopts a loose fighting stance. A 41-year-old Geraldton man is due in court today, charged with sexually assaulting a teenage girl. Police say the man knew his victim through his role as a local sports coach. It's alleged he assaulted her in November last year. He's been charged with supplying alcohol to a juvenile and sexual penetration without consent. And the federal government has agreed to a multi-million dollar settlement for victims of the former coalition government's illegal robo-debt scheme. The automatic debt recovery program issued more than 400,000 unjustified debt notices to welfare recipients. The Commonwealth is set to pay $475 million plus additional legal and administration fees, which could total $80 million. Belinda, there'll be more news at 1 o'clock.
Tony, thank you for that update. 28 to 1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Great to have you along. Still to come between now and the news at 1 o'clock, you're going to catch up with Kununurra cotton grower Fritz Bolton, and he's pretty excited. He's just got back from a great trip to Brazil. It was a real eye-opener as far as agricultural systems go, and he's going to share some of that experience with you shortly. And we'll also be heading to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market. First, though, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology. Grace Abbott is with you today. Grace, it might look okay around parts of the Southwest Land Division today, but there is some rain on the way.
That's exactly right. Yes, look, we will start in the south, though I will point out today most of the action is in the southeast. So there we have a cloud band lingering, and that's bringing showers and quite a few storms to the area around Norseman and to the east of there. So since 9 a.m, we had 13 millimetres fall at Norseman, though those showers and storms have continued east. So for the rest of the rainfall will occur mostly about the Eucla district, around that 5 to 15 millimetres before the cloud band disperses tomorrow. But as you mentioned, for Friday, the headline is a strong cold front that we have on the way. So that'll arrive at the southwest capes overnight tonight and push inland throughout the day tomorrow. So folks southwest of about Exmouth to Israelite Bay will be in for a drop tomorrow, though those heaviest falls will occur southwest of Durian Bay down to Manjimup. And we're expecting around 20 to 30 millimetres about that part of the coast, though we will see some training of showers, though I can't tell you exactly where, but there is a chance that that training will lead to some isolated totals up to 50 to 60 millimetres. So further inland, places like Mora, Northam and Katanning are up for around 10 to 20 millimetres, dropping off to 2 to 10 millimetres around Meriden to Southern Cross. In addition to that rain, we will see some windy conditions following the front about the west and then on Saturday about the south coast as that low pressure system passes by. So just a heads up to keep an eye on our warnings in case we spot anything severe. So into Saturday, that front is continuing inland, looking at 20 to 30 millimetres southwest of about Geraldton to Collie and about 5 to 15 millimetres extending to Esperance, mostly in the morning and the afternoon. And that rainfall drops off inland to about Kalgoorlie with 2 to 10 millimetres as that leading edge of the front passes by. And again, those showers and storms may be a bit gusty as they pass. Finally, for Sunday, we've got that trough bringing We have a new trough approaching the southwest, and that'll bring renewed rainfall of 2 to 10 millimetres southwest of around Dongara to Katanning to Esperance, with light falls 0 to 2 millimetres inland throughout the wheat belt. Finally, on Monday, we have a passing light shower, less than 2 millimetres, about the southwest land division, but it's more focused around the south coast in an onshore flow. And I will point out that there is the chance of frost throughout the great southern and southern parts of the wheat belt on Monday, and that sort of spreads in land that it covers through to Tuesday and Wednesday as we have a high-pressure ridge come in and clearing skies in the south.
Well, thank you for those details. Let's move into northern and a little bit more information on the eastern part of Western Australia. What can you see over the next 4 days?
Yeah, so up in the north, it is very tied to what's happening in the south, as the tail end of that front will pass by places up to the far western Pilbara on Friday and Saturday. So generally less than 2 millimetres around the western Pilbara, but increasing up to 2 to 10 millimetres about Carnarvon and Denham on Friday. Then for the remainder of the period about the north, we're seeing pretty settled conditions continuing through to Monday, though there is some hints of a surface trough that could bring a light afternoon shower to parts of the eastern Kimberley and the northern interior.
Great. Thank you so much, Grace. Appreciate that. It is 24 minutes to one. Richard Hudson is here now to take a look at the rainfall figures.
Yeah, hardly any at all, really. In the Goldfields, Laverton and Norseman recorded 3, and then in the southern coastal region, Chain Beach had 4 and Salmon Gums Research Station 2, and that's pretty much reading out everywhere that got rain in the last 24 hours. But because it's been so sunny and nice, it certainly did make it very, very nice at Newdigate yesterday. I might have even got a little bit burnt on my back of my my neck, I reckon. I forgot to take I took everything else for the cold, forgot to take the sunscreen. You don't normally pack sunscreen when you go to Newdigate for the field day. But Grace just mentioned the frost that's forecast for early next week in some areas. I know that's not nice to hear, but unless you know something might be coming. I did chat to a few people about frost at Newdigate, because obviously this is a nervous window for so many people who've got grain or pastures as well. Most were saying, look, they've heard of a little bit of light frost here and there. It's still too early to tell if it's going to cause any damage. But Tara de Landgraaf was also there, and she chatted to Peter Walker, who farms 20 kilometres just west of Newdigate. He's a Suffolk stud breeder and grain farmer, and says the area has had some frost in recent weeks, but hopefully it hasn't caused too much damage.
Particularly cold this last week. We had a run in July of frost, but this last week I think we had 3 mornings below -2, and it was 0 this morning.
Have you been able to assess yet if that's had any damage?
It definitely has had some damage, but it's much easier to check in another couple of weeks when you can check it at about 110 out the window of the ute.
Those cold mornings, you say, hopefully just some light frost, because Newdigate, you know what frost is.
Oh yeah, we always get some frost. There's a dozen things that change how damaging it is. A late evening rain just before the frost will obviously cause a lot more stem frost. Being on the sand with low organic matter increases the frost. High aspect, yeah, there's a dozen things, so you just don't get too caught up in it if you can avoid it.
There's been a real difference in crop growth this year as well, because the crop that went in early got up early, but that crop that went in a little bit later, it's been quite a cold winter and they're quite far apart.
Yeah, it's actually really good for the frost mitigation. Been more challenging for applying N and also for applying the broadleaf chemicals, but yeah, no, it's been a good season. I'll take a bit of variation. Eggs in each basket's always good.
I hear and I see that you put some crop into the feedlot paddock this year, and that seems to be going well as well.
If all my crop grew like that, I'd plant all my crop in July every year. It is amazing. It's just a fluke.
Why plant the feedlot?
It was actually blowing away. It had got bare to the point that every wind it was blowing, and it was actually killing the crop next to the feedlot. So I thought I'd plant some stuff in there. And yeah, it's been amazing.
Is it something you'd consider again, planting something a little bit later?
Oh, we used to do it a bit when we were more managing our sheep numbers. But we've probably got our sheep numbers low enough that we don't have to do it. Newdigate's notorious for frost, but also for angry finishes. You know, there's a fair chance that really heavy crop in the feedlot's going to run out of water late September.
You mentioned those sheep, and we're here at Newdigate Field Days. You've got some of the rams behind you, Suffolks and White Suffolks. How are they looking this year?
They look particularly good this year. They probably didn't have the kindest January through to March run, but we got a really good rain through the part of the farm where they live in April at Easter, and it's been pretty good since. So our sheep are always a reflection of the feed available on the farm.
You don't have an on-farm sale, you have on-farm paddock selection instead. Are you still finding that there is demand out there? We've seen a lot of ewes exit the system in the last 12 months.
Yeah, we've been extremely fortunate. Terrible for the industry that so many people have left, but fortunately for us, a lot of them have bought our rams on the way out, so that's helped us. Hasn't been great for the long-term future of our sheep, but it's a bit of a cash injection on the way out.
As a breeder, how do I suppose you go forward, given that, as you say, people are leaving the industry? How do you deal with it?
You manage what you can manage. Obviously, the more money that we make out of sheep, you can tell your clients how it's working and which clients are doing it well and what's working for everyone. Cropping is quite expensive. The inputs are quite high at the moment. So if sheep increase their output just a bit more, they'll match up well and the system will have a bit more balance again.
And, of course, Newdigate being that prime example of mixed enterprise, and we're having a look over here at the ewe hoggart competition, and I hear there are an increased number of entries this year, so the sheep game still live and well.
People that are still in it are generally quite passionate and quite proud of what they're doing, and like to show everyone what they're doing, and good sheep attract attention. I think particularly given that there's a motorbike that's been supplied this year as a prize.
Well, speaking of the ewe hoggart competition, I've made my way over there now. Bryce Sinclair, you're the person in charge here, and there are a lot more sheep than I remember last year. Is that right?
No, certainly. I think last year we ran with 7 entrants, and this year we've got 13. So pretty well doubled the entrants, and it's really good. You know, there's positivity in the market with sheep, meat and wool sort of thing. Like, there's sheep come from 300-400 k's away sort of thing, which is great, where normally it's just been more local.
And how are the sheep looking this year? Because it's been a pretty good season.
It's been a very good season. We were very lucky out this way with a good start. Probably luckier than some other areas, but then obviously the rains have come and feed quality seems very good this year as well. So there's not really any sheep in here that aren't looking really good.
And are you finding farmers in the region are happy they've kept sheep for those who have kept them, and maybe those who got out wish they hadn't?
Well, I'm certainly happy we've stuck to our guns, and like, we're not changing much of what we're doing. We're just sticking to our normal sort of numbers. Look, the guys that have probably gone out of them are guys that might have been thinking about it anyway. And now I suppose if anyone's going out of it, you're going to grab your money and run, which is great for them. But I'm pretty optimistic that the next few years are looking quite good and there's a chance to make a good quid for years to come and hopefully a long time to come.
And have you dusted off the checkbook for the ram selling season? There's not too many ewes left, but what are you expecting price-wise?
I think with rams this year, like, everyone wants good sheep. So the good sheep are still going to make good money. Generally, it's worth paying for the genetics. If that's what you want and that's what you want to grow, that's what you buy, sort of thing. You don't buy the ram that you don't want. So I think the prices are still going to be strong. Maybe numbers might be down, so averages might be down a bit, but I think the top end will still be there purely because people want the best sheep that they can buy.
Newdigate farmer Bryce Sinclair at the ewe hoggart competition at the Newdigate Field Days, and he was speaking to Tara DeLandgraft. 17-1. A Kununurra cotton grower is just back from an eye-opening trip to Brazil, where he saw up close the world's largest centre pivot irrigation system. Fritz Bolton was part of a business tour exploring farming techniques on the other side of the globe. And the trip came at a really crucial time as the Kimberley enters a new chapter in cotton production. He says the huge scale of the centre pivot and farming operation was impressive, but he thinks it'd be a nightmare to manage.
This centre pivot was 470 hectares. It was in the Bahia region of Brazil. And yes, it was impressive. They had put a new centre pivot on where four centre pivots had been before. The crop didn't look all that spectacular on there. They were still doing a fair bit of soil amelioration to get the virgin or unproductive soil productive. And they do that by adding lime, some cover cropping, and adding lots of fertiliser.
What was it like to see this massive centre pivot? Was it insane to see?
It looked like a nightmare to me. Lots of pumping, lots of energy, lots of moving parts, and it was for supplementary irrigation, so it was only just supplying enough water to tick the crop along. They really needed rain as well, which is what they get. But I was very grateful that we have a different, more sustainable or less energy-drawing irrigation system here in the Ord where we water with gravity, really.
Do you know what the reasoning or the thought process behind having such a large centre pivot is?
Yeah, look, everything we saw in Brazil was about scale. We saw, like most farms are 10,000 hectares, certainly nothing more than a few thousand hectares, and they have got an incredible climate, incredible rainfall, and so for them to do their cropping, it's all about getting the jobs done on time, and big fields give you scale, give you efficiency. That's why they did it.
And you mentioned that there's a different process you use here. So what do you use here on your cotton farm?
We've got a totally different soil type. Their soils are very light and sandy, extremely well draining. We're farming on heavy, what we call self-mulching soils, verticile soils, clay. And if you're using centre pivots like that, you'd always be having issues with the centre pivot bogging, because when it's wet here, the soil is very soft and sticky. We've got very high magnesium levels, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's not necessarily suited. So because we've got Lake Argyle and all the irrigation area supplies water into the valley through gravity, we just furrow irrigate with siphons and don't have to pump any water.
And did you have any conversations or many conversations with the farmers over in Brazil? Did you learn anything interesting or something that might have opened your mind a little bit?
Oh, many, many things. Certainly, they did a lot of double cropping. We've been trying to do that here and have had mixed success where we've grown beans and corn. But I think the real standout from what I saw that's absolutely critical that we must maintain here is the integrity of the GM technology for growing the cotton. The only reason we're able to grow cotton in Kununurra, and that might be an exaggeration, but is because we've got Bolgut-3. So the VIP-3A protein controls the Spodoptera caterpillars. And in Brazil, because they didn't adhere to their resistant management strategy very well, none of that GM technology works anymore. So they're spraying a lot to protect their crop and get the yields that they do. Again, I don't want to take away from that. They're getting exceptionally high yields on their rain-grown cottons, similar yields to what we're getting here in irrigated cotton, but we don't have to spray like they do, and I don't ever want to get to that stage. So our resistant management strategy and work and money that we spend on making sure that technology will continue to work is absolutely critical.
Were there any other stark differences or similarities that you noticed while you were over there observing their operations?
Yeah, so the climate was really similar, same latitude as what we are. The weather was a bit milder, a few degrees cooler, a bit more rain, but they just had scale. And they're all pioneers. In other words, they moved to these areas where there's now 400 cotton gins operating, really the biggest cotton producers on the planet, the biggest exporters of cotton in the world, whereas 45 years ago, even 40 years ago, there was nothing.
Yeah, it's an interesting time for you to have gone when in Kununurra we're at the beginning of the cotton industry here. We've just opened the gin, so to see the way they operate, having been in the game a little longer, that's a motivating thing to see, perhaps.
Yeah, it was. It did sort of make me a little bit sad as well. Like, we've been battling to build one cotton gin here for the last 7 or 8 years, and it really has been tough. And when I saw how many new gins were being built at the moment and how many they're planning to build and how many they have built in the last few years, where you're doing something wrong. Like, it's a lot easier to do that over there than what it is here.
Do you think that now that gin has opened, we are progressing here in Kununurra?
Oh, definitely. Yep, we just don't, you know, these start-up phases are always particularly hard, and I think these next 2 years, there won't be very many people that'll make any money. There'll be lots of hard lessons learnt, and there'll be a lot of pain, both from an agronomic point of view, so from growing the crop, from processing the crop, and especially logistics. So we've all got to be really, really aware that these next couple of years are going to be extremely exciting, and it's all very positive. But I know that in my business, I've made sure that I've got enough borrowing capacity to get through this hump that we know we're running into. For example, we don't have our first point of entry operating yet at the Wyndham port, so we need to make sure we can get containers in and out of Wyndham to export and import fertiliser and cotton and other goods. We've just built a brand new cotton gin. Nothing new ever works the way you envisage it, and there's a lot of fine-tuning and a lot of heartache that the incredible team that are running and building that have got to go through these next few months. We've learnt a number of different ways to grow crops up here, but cotton is a totally new cropping system. So from the farmer's perspective, we've also got to learn how to grow this crop well and efficiently, and are going to make lots of mistakes while we're being innovative and learning new ways to grow this.
How has your cotton season gone? I can see baled up cotton outside. Have you taken any to the gin yet? Yeah, how have things gone?
We're quietly confident that our cotton will be okay. I think we've made a few mistakes, and the season this year has been particularly difficult for cotton. Cotton is an indeterminate perennial, so it's essentially a tree, so it wants to grow vegetatively all the time and will only put fruit on when there's a bit of stress, and I think we've all been growing crops that are a bit different, and haven't been stressing our cotton enough. So there's a few inefficiencies out in the paddock at the moment. We've got a very tall crop, and that makes picking a lot more difficult, and it's also very inefficient. The bottom of the crop has got no fruit on it, so there's no fibre or seed there. And that then makes everything a bit less efficient, and you're just not going to get the maximum yield potential out of the crop. We're very much limited, like Brazil, by the amount of sunlight that we have. We've relatively short day length, and especially at the beginning of the season, fair bit of potential for overcast weather and rain, etc. So we're limited there. But the yields we're seeing so far, we're actually pretty pleased with, but we know we can do better. Mm-hmm. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I think we've seen some of the mistakes we've made and are able to admit to that, and hopefully we can do it better.
Kununurra farmer Fritz Bolton speaking to Jess Baker about the recent trip to Brazil and their early days of growing cotton in the Kimberley. These days, his focus is on cotton, but he also grows corn, beans, sandalwood and a few other crops. 8:01, just before the news at 1 o'clock, we'll head to Mount Barker and see how the cattle were selling today. First, the latest figures from the Australian Government commodity forecaster ABARES predicts Australian agriculture at the farm gate will be worth $94.7 billion in 2025-26. Now, that is very close to the National Farmers Federation's goal of being worth $100 billion by 2030. President of the NFF, David Johinke, says the numbers are very impressive.
It's great news to see agriculture doing so well in the light or in the challenges of drought in the southeast, but then also acknowledging that there's absolutely been huge challenges with the amount of water that's happened in the north. And to be able to see such strong livestock prices has been one of the key drivers of the increased values, noting too that there is some challenges around crop production, that it's going to fall away slightly in the holistic number that we see. But to acknowledge that $100 billion is a near reality in this financial year is excellent, but we've also got to remember the five pillars that underpin the number, the headline number that we talk about.
Yeah, because this is all part of your roadmap to 2030, right? So what do you make of the health of agriculture? If it's worth $94.7 billion, does that mean it's in a good place?
As a whole, it means that we've got opportunity to prosper under these circumstances, but it also has to be acknowledged that we've got a lot of headwinds around the cost of production, the amount of challenges that we're seeing in the local communities, if it's renewables or different changes in land use, especially when we talk around water policy. We've got issues around supply chain and investment in infrastructure. So it does demonstrate that we are doing a really good job in challenging scenarios, but it also shows that if we want to be more, if we want to push that number even further, we have to get some of these pillars right once again around that value chain, the growth and sustainability, making sure that we've got innovation, people and capital to help drive our businesses.
The NFF used to publish an update on how it was going, a report card on how it was going for the 2030 roadmap. You haven't done that since 2023. Is there any reason behind that?
Other than we've had a few other issues on the boil, and noting too that we still do report back to all of our members about some of the key issues that we've been seeing, but no, we haven't been publicising it, haven't been putting a document out, but it's still been one of the things that we've been keeping an eye on, and also acknowledging that, once again, there's been challenges in every step of the way.
And it's still a goal to get to $100 billion in farm gate value by 2030.
Absolutely. Not only is it to achieve $100 billion, but it's trying to hold it at that $100 billion, because we do know that that number has bounced around, and that we also, if we had done nothing just via the efficiencies of farms, that number would have always grown. It's how can we ensure that we continue to be above that $100 billion and also push that number as far as we can to give value back to farmers.
President of the National Farmers Federation, David Johinke, speaking to Warwick Long, and those latest figures from ABARES predicting Australian agriculture at the farm gate to be worth $94.7 billion in 2025-26.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Two authoritarian leaders who've both extended their grips on power, caught discussing immortality in a rare unscripted moment in President Xi Jinping's tightly choreographed military celebration in Beijing. A tragic end to a tourist ride in Lisbon. At least 15 died when the city's famous funicular railway derailed. And a 34-hour game of touch football set to break records on Bondi Beach.
That's not far away at 3 minutes to one. There's a major change underway at Cockatoo Island off WA's Kimberley Coast, a site with a long history of high-grade iron ore mining. Pearl Gull Iron has told the ASX it's selling its Cockatoo Island project for $4.5 million, a 4% stake in the buyer and future royalties. The buyer, Buccaneer Resources, is owned by Crestlink, which plans to develop a $100 million marine supply base on the island. Located about 250 kilometres north of Broome and just over 5 kilometres from the mainland, Cockatoo Island has seen both mining and tourism over the years. The deal still requires shareholder approvals, but if it all goes ahead, it's expected to be finalised by the end of the year. A couple of minutes to one. Let's head to Mount Barker, where some prices were up at the cattle sale this morning. Tracy Kilner, hello. It sounds like it was an interesting sale. Can you run through the details?
Only 658 cattle today. That's down 152 from last week. But the quality was definitely up. There was some really good quality yarding. Local and interstate processors were active, while the feeder buyers were once again chasing the heavier weight young cattle. Heavyweight cows gained 40 cents with demand, while heavy bulls remained firm on last week's gain. The weaner steers sold for 410 to 480 cents for heavyweights, and from 416 to 478 cents for the lighter weights. The weaner heifers made 340 to 392 cents for heavyweights, and from 342 to 384 cents for the lighter weights. Yearling cattle remained firm, with steers selling from 390 to 466 cents, and the yearling heifers returned 352 to 404 cents a kilo. Grown steers weighing over 600 kilos made 350 to 390 cents, while the lighter weights under 600 kilos sold from 362 up to 394 cents a kilo. Grown heifers weighing under 540 kilos gained, selling from 310 to 386 cents, and the heavier weights returned 310 to 390 cents a kilo. The heavyweight cows continued to gain, selling from 292 to 364 cents, and store cows held firm at 250 to 264 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls sold from 286 to 330 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for going through those details. And this text just through in responding to the Bee Industry Council of Western Australia, just urging all of us to remain vigilant following the recent detection of varroa in South Australia's Riverland. This from Stuart. He says, once again, our eastern states are letting the Western Australian people down with their lack of biosecurity. At our border, there needs to be a fully equipped fumigating program for all vehicles entering Western Australia. Thank you for that, Stuart. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.